Welcome to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White, and joining me today is Carmen Perry. Carmen, how are you doing, sir?
I am living dangerously.
What
folks don't know is that I've been getting progressively closer to game time when I take my last sip of water prior to the podcast. And I almost completely failed there, but I'm glad I made it back just in time, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I obviously sped up in order to try and put you on the spot.
Indeed. Different kind of show today. I like when we have a different kind of show. We always have different shows, but
we do, you know, for sure. Yeah. But you know, it's not often that we have someone with a diversity of experience and. You know, expertise on as our guest today.
Yeah, and a fun little niche topic too. Let's just jump right in because I think it's going to be cool.
Sure. So joining us today is Carl Tolbert. Carl is an author and researcher and head engineer at Molloy Electric and recent author of the book, The 10 Immutable Laws of the Industrial Distribution Specialist. So welcome to The Cooler Ring, Carl.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Carl, it's quite a resume that Jeff just rattled off.
It's bigger than that, I think, too.
Yeah, and I'm going to resist the urge to ask you where you get the time to do all these things. Maybe I'll jump right into the book. What led you down the path of writing this? Tell us about what got you inspired to do that.
Well, I've been a specialist, an application engineer, you know, for the last 20 some years. For industrial distributor in Georgia and Florida. And then in 22, right on the heels of COVID, like all of us, a lot of folks went back to school. And then I finished my doctorate in 2022. And the topic of my dissertation and my research was industrial distribution, right? And through it, I interviewed 32 distribution leaders broken up into three distinct groups, distributors, independent rep agents, and brands. And along the way, it dawned on me that with, really what's going on with distribution, either you're going to become a logistics company purely, or you're going to do value add. So you're picking. And to do value add, you have to have industrial specialists, application engineers, subject matter experts. And I found that that idea alone was really underserved, which led to the book, The 10 Immutable Laws.
So is it, as you surveyed the landscape, that you just felt like the role was undervalued, or that it was being or even diminishing over the time of your research?
Oh yeah, because see, what I found was every distributor, every rep agent, every brand deployed technical specialists differently. And some had metrics, some had they decide, well, we're going to go hire all these advanced education folks, bypassing practical experience. You know, so there was almost these best practices that started becoming more and more prevalent as I spoke to people about what worked and what didn't work. And that's kind of what materialized in this whole discussion. Now, once upon a time, Frank Hurt, very well-known industrial distribution like mentor and consultant, he wrote a book in 2008 about being an industrial specialist as well, but the book was through one of the wholesale distribution groups, and then it went out of print, and it was more about tactics than it was. So mine was a significant departure from the only other thing like it in existence.
So as part of me always tries to tug this back towards the manufacturing and industrial marketer and what they ought to know, or how this ought to change how they think about what it is they're doing. But I guess I'd almost go one step before that and ask, how much of the there seems like there's a bit of a thrust towards cutting out distribution in some regards. A lot of manufacturers feel that they can go direct. How much of what you're seeing is a result of that thrust?
Significant, right? So you got a couple fronts. So you have Amazon crossing the threshold of $40 billion, right? And, you know, everybody fears Amazon. I'll get to kind of an anecdote about that in a minute. But so in Europe, you know, manufacturers deal directly with users. There's no distribution, really. In China, it actually is very similar to the United States. In China, they have distribution in some other areas like France. There was another dissertation by this this researcher that was somewhat akin to mine, you know, published out of France because they do have some distribution as well. But so in Atlanta, I can't remember which think tank, but a gentleman named Abel Noir has been writing about the direct business pushes by manufacturing. And why this makes sense is there's a struggle between the three groups about who to get closest to the customer, right? So a distribution represents the closest group to the customer in most cases, but it's a mile, what's the old saying, an inch deep, a mile wide. You know, distributors generally distribute like a lot of different brands, where rep agents are often in the middle and they represent five to 15 brands. And you have just brands that generally have one, you know, obviously sometimes they have a sub brands, but generally they all struggle to get closest to the customer. And right now distribution, when they hold that, that data that of who the customer is and what they're buying, there's a certain level of power in that. And that's protection. And that's where a lot of this tension comes from. That all three groups expressed to me individually, you know, and when you do qualitative interviews, you know, I'm governed by an IRB and all the laws of protection, just like drug trials, but there's a certain level of anonymity that I have where I get a lot of honesty that I would never have gotten otherwise. So it was very significant, the insight that I got from, all 32 interviews.
What would you say was the most surprising thing about what you heard from the distributor's side?
Oh, okay. From the distributor side, they have this this inherent fear that everybody's always taken their business, and it's true to some extent, but primarily it's from the logistics side, right? And this is one of the things that everybody agreed on, is that if I'm selling a part or a widget or a component that's very commoditized and it's I'm just doing it on price, right? Then all of a sudden you have no protection. It's price driven. It's different. And distributors, especially independent ones, are evolving into the value added model, because now it matters less the brand, but more the knowledge of the specialist or the technical sales folks or who's applying the product and creating that solution. And you make significantly more than just the selling on price and parts. So everybody agrees on these tactics, just the approach is different. And you see this almost with the decline of e-commerce stores with a lot of distributors now. Remember, there was a push for e-commerce, and then a lot of them now are saying, hey, this is a weak investment. I really can't have this because I'm losing that war to the Grangers and MasterCards, the eBays, the Amazons, the Emotions, all these people with these Goliath e-commerce platforms, you know.
Is it realistic to think that you're going to be able to maintain the relationship driven side of that sale if you can't service the electronic side of that sale, if that makes sense?
Well, there's been a debate on that, right? Because, you know, Punch Out and all these manufacturers saying, hey, you got to have e-commerce to comply. And I think there's kind of this hybrid approach where maybe they have a storefront or a catalog or a ERP system that allows you to do that, but it's not going to be like a B to little B or a B to C type of sales process. I think they're still out there, but there's a lot of distributors who have completely abandoned all of e-commerce completely.
Do the brands not, you know, speaking about, you know, a technical sales specialist at the distributor level, do brands not see the power of that? I get that they may be concerned about who owns the relationship and who owns the data, but I have to think that for the end customer, having that person in place who truly understands the technology, truly understands the, you know, how things work together, all of that, wouldn't they see some of the power in that?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. So I had one brand confide in me that they hated specialists because it took the power of knowledge away from them because they wanted to be relied on and then they can control. And like, I have my thumb on the distributor. And this happens a lot with the automation side of the business, like sensors and those things, right? So there's a certain power play. The other thing is there's a high level of hubris that reps and brands have where they feel that, hey, I'm the brand and I have all this knowledge. And most times distributors don't have these experts in the field. And I beg to differ. There's a lot of specialists I've spoken with over the years, you know, in reliability into automation or bearing and PT and you name it. There's just a significant amount, and that's how distributors actually start to succeed more and more if the specialist business is handled correctly, right? Which is, you know, again, the 10 laws, but the brands have this weird, you know, love-hate relationship with it. They don't like the big distributors that don't need them because they can't control them. So they must get closer to the customer, and this is why things like POS and MAP policies and these other things have all kind of adapted over the last several years to kind of mitigate some of that power that distribution has by just simply knowing where the customers are.
Understanding that tension, are there any brands that stand out to you or stood out in your research as running counter to that, that seem to really collaborate incredibly well with the distribution specialist that leaned into that collaboration versus into the tension of it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think, you know, it's tough because, you know, it's pockets of brilliance. It's not just overall. See, what I've also found is that when you start looking, because I also created this thing that's not part of the book called it's a variant of the Net Promoter Score that I use as a vendor or brand report card. And so you guys are familiar with the Net Promoter Score, obviously, right? The, you know, what you recommend, you know, this brand to your friends and family. You know, that was Reichfeld's initial idea, right? But it doesn't go far enough. So I expanded into, you know, four more questions talking about product quality or ease of doing business and pricing. And the last one was support. And what I found through that, because I had three major brands run my report cards. I won't mention them because it's all part of the IRB and academic stuff, right? But what we found was relationships in the field regionally, that person matters to the distributor. So if a brand is national, for instance, and say they have, 20 different brand representatives in the field, whether it's an industrial, like an independent rep agent or a brand employee, those individuals' relationships with the distributors make all the difference in the world. So it doesn't matter if you have the technical people or not. It's all about that relationship. And it's shockingly clear, actually, right? So if the distributor sees no value of this individual that the brand hired, then no matter what happens, they're not going to work with that individual, period. And I've seen this play out with all my interviews as well as the other research I've done that's unpublished at this point.
It doesn't paint a picture of something that's particularly easy to break into.
Oh, no, it is not. It's very cloistered. It's very, you know, but we call distribution almost kind of like a mafia. You know, once you're in, that's what you do. What we find is that a distributor can go work for a rep agency or a brand, but it's very difficult to get a brand person to go work for a distributor because, you know, they don't have deep pockets. It's different. It's entrepreneurial. It's very much a faster pace, and you have to deal with all of the brands, not just one. And this is always a shocker to the brand folks that do try to work for a distributor. They generally don't last long.
What do you you mentioned that, you know, distribution is kind of a uniquely North American phenomenon, somewhat mm-hmm. with some prevalence in Europe and stuff like that. What do you attribute that to? Is it just the sheer scale of our landmass here?
Actually, that's one of the laws is about proximity. So the remoteness of folks anymore isn't cutting it. So to to actually effectively create these relationships and grow this business with expertise and knowledge and value add, the specialist has to be somewhat close to the action. And the folks that are relying purely on remote, because that's what COVID did, actually are having a hard time of it anymore, right? And so this is kind of part of this bigger point, is in Europe, you can drive across Germany, what, how many hours? You know, try driving across Texas, right? You know, or like when I drive across, you know, South Dakota all the way to, you know, Williston in North Dakota. I mean, it's like an 8-hour trip. It's like going from Atlanta to Ocala. You know, it's just, you know, the geography in North America is so tremendously big. And I think they got used to that because, you know, like you get Siemens, so they're used by all these brands in Germany, and the drive of choice in Amsterdam is Danfoss. You know, you have these country relationships that you just are very solid. And then when you go over there, I remember meeting, going to Finland and, you know, meeting with ABB, this is a few years ago. And, they were just shocked. They were shocked we didn't do, you know, use the service that the Europeans did. They were shocked that we didn't do all this other stuff. And a lot of it came down to purely geography.
You mentioned about them. I mean, it's interesting to consider that power of proximity. And I'm kind of, maybe this is a silly question, but part of me wonders, how much of the work is actually still happening remotely, but it's important that it's done remotely by somebody that's actually reasonably close to you?
Yeah, I get it. I get it. There was a famous story that your customers won't buy from you unless you're local, right? And this guy moved his warehouse like to another country, and his customers never noticed. You know, it's anecdotal, but what I find is that when a specialist has to physically walk in the plant to look at an application, is the difference. Right, supplying parts, you know, it's a little different, you know, purely being remote, but the support characteristics are, you know, and even with AI, you know, I write a lot about AI in the book. There's a whole separate chapter about AI being a multiplier. And I do a lot of research on AI as well, both blame and, you know, that's the new, what I call the tertiary orality, is another paper I'm working on, where it's like digitally mediated. So we're almost like moving back to, you know, talking around the campfire, but that's another story. But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, even, you know, specialists don't fear AI. You know, AI is kind of a, you know, it helps the job, but ultimately the technical person has to own the suggestions and the AI data that's used, right? Because there's actually a case right now, it's in litigation, and I can't, but there was this $3 million error from a food company that they relied on data from AI exclusively. And it was a complete colossal, just catastrophe, right? And so it's going on right now. And I think about that. I use that as almost a lightning rod going, you know, that's why you still need human oversight. Because the engineering's there, the math is there. I've ran tons of tests. I've ran statistical analysis through AI and did it by hand programming in R or Python. And I'm coming up with the same data, but sometimes it gets something so minor wrong. You're like, oh, really? You know? And so, I think AI use is there. It's going to be around forever. I mean, it's changing and evolving, but it's just a matter of, you know, every organization has to come up with standardization of usage. Right. And, but again, it's just, I write exclusively about this in the book as well, and how it's taking shape. You know, it's pretty exciting.
When we talk about that evolving role of the specialist, and, you know, and even the kind of renewed power of the specialist kind of post-COVID, mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's at least some level of intersection with the great change out that's happening in our workforce right now. I'm kind of curious what you've found in your research about how that role is changing as new people are moving into it. Is there a Is there a style of specialist that's dying off? Is there a way of doing business that we're not going to see again?
Well, that's an awesome question. Yeah. So what I'm seeing, you know, I talk about this. So education, right? So there was a push for a long time to get people with degrees and, you know, advanced education, engineering, et cetera. And the reality is that the specialists are more successful coming from the plants themselves, from the industries that they're trying to serve. So if I'd rather, there was a famous example I used in the book about this group, you know, it was a bunch of technical specialists a distributor hired. And this guy had like a master's degree from an elite university in mechanical engineering, and he couldn't generate sales, right? It just was just a complete, you know, utter failure. And then his replacement was a third shift maintenance guy, supervisor from one of the local plants. And the guy crushed it, like 2 million in sales in the first 3 months. And it wasn't, it was just the, you spoke the language, you knew the business. It wasn't, you know, and honestly, even my work now in engineering, you know, it's a Pareto, you know, 80% of what I see is 20% of, you know, basic knowledge. You know, it's just, it's not that hard. It's mostly experience. Then I get into hard stuff. You know, it does come up once in a while, but I have vast resources that could help me from the brands and other places if I do actually get stuck. So, but you need somebody that speaks that language, that gets it, that's had those problems on, you know, at 2 a.m. That's really what, and that's where you get your new candidates for work. So you go get those folks, you know, they're already learning the hard way from manufacturing, you know, or municipalities or from the water, you know, all the pumping people, the water operators, you know, you pull from that versus just, you know, the higher end education. I mean, you do have unicorns, and I'm one of those unicorns. I know several, but you know, it's just, if I'm a distributor and I'm hiring specialists, that's kind of the pool I want to look at first.
Doesn't that mean that it's going to be incredibly difficult for young people to break into this? I mean, if you need that kind of level and depth of experience and having been in the trenches when stuff breaks and being able to problem solve and fix that, you know, those are not, you know, advanced education or not, right? You know, kids are not coming up with that level of knowledge.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's, you have to have a proving ground for the next generation, which is field service, their mechanics, their electricians, you know, their trades, there's lots of opportunities in those fields. And that's really where they have to learn the same way I did. I mean, I started out as an electrician in high school, and then I became, you know, I was in the Navy. And I was a technician in the Navy. And then, you know, so it kind of builds across time. So you can't have it instantly is really the point. You know, I remember recently I was talking to one of the tech school guys we hired as a field service person at Malloy. And he talked to me about how much of an expert he was at PLCs. And I said, okay, well, how many PLCs have you done in the field? You know, we don't really work on a lot. You know, mostly we do drives and motors and stuff like that. And he's like, well, I've never programmed a PLC in the field, just school. I'm like, okay. Well, you know, it's, I tell you what, if once you've done a plant and a couple machines, and I can say that you're up to that intermediate level of PLC knowledge. But right now you have a taste of it, my friend, but nothing more.
I think it all points to, kind of shared Jeff's question in that, or at least I think what's embedded in your question, Jeff, is just, man, it's like going to be awfully hard to actually replenish these specialists as folks retire out. That's going to be a serious recruiting challenge. But of course, it also speaks to the recruiting challenge for manufacturers who are trying to displace that level of closer to the customer knowledge. It's not something that's easy to execute on, frankly.
Yeah, well, I also find, you know, you're kind of alluding to something else as well as the sales enablement, you know, one of the things we find is that you can find a very, you know, a good group of energetic and, you know, high potential sellers that are young, that don't have a lot of experience, but how do you get them to work with the venerable, almost curmudgeon group of specialists? And it's an art to itself. is getting the engineers and the technical people, the specialists, to work with a new group of sellers that have no idea how to make that happen. And a lot of organizations are struggling with that right now. I know one of the biggest motor rewind companies in the world, you know, they have like 400 salesmen. They have no idea how to get them to work with whether, you know, the specialists of the brands, the reps, or the other, the distributors on their own team. They struggle with that significantly. And it's another chapter of my book is how to work with specialists. Yeah, so I think that's actually going to be turn out to be one of the more popular chapters, I think.
Is it? I mean, obviously, it can't be the technical gap that we're trying to overcome there, because then the only solution would be that the salespeople have to become technically smarter, and that seems maybe harder to do. So what is the solution there?
The technical adeptness comes with time. That's just all it is. But get the groups to work together is understanding that, hey, listen, you have two types of sales calls. You know, one's the milk run, one's the professional sales call where you have like an agenda and a purpose. And it's just understanding how this works is you show up with an agenda, you have an audience, you have the specialist there to talk about something specific, right? And always have something, you know, a reason to come back, you know. But then there's this illusion that like I have to have, you know, all these sales calls scheduled that are like that. But the reality is you only need one or two, and the rest of them could be milk runs. You know, they could be just introductory calls. But it's just a process of, all right, you have to, this is how this works. Right. But there also has to be metrics involved where everything's activity based. So part of the commission or the structure of the seller has to be involved with, OK, you have to ride with the sellers. You have to do demos. You have to do lunch and learns. You have to do all these things that specialists provide or the brands provide. And the people that are already successful already do that without being prompted. So there's just this thing about how the nuts and bolts works. And once people get it, and then there is some metrics that actually go with it. And the simplest one is just, you know, engagement, right? So once you start getting that that going, then all of a sudden it's not as difficult. I think that getting over the initial hump of how this is supposed to work is the biggest problem I've seen with distributors working, you know, between new sellers and specialists.
Carl, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm struggling to know even how I want to try to bring it to a close. But I think I feel like you're contrary enough. You may have an answer to this question. I'm just wondering, as you look on the horizon, what's something that we in the way that the go-to-market motion that industrial distributors kind of serve, the customers that they serve, the value that they provide. What as you look ahead 5-10 years, is there something that stands out that you think people just don't understand, that they don't see something that's coming that you do, or maybe the other way around? Everybody assumes it's going to change in one way, and you're not buying it. I'd be curious where you think your crystal ball departs the most from conventional wisdom in the sector, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's great. Great question. So, you know, distributors are going to continue to be gobbled up by bigger organizations, right? So that's the first thing, is that, you know, a lot of the independents, the family businesses, they're changing. A lot of them are continuing being sold off to the bigger organizations, but you see less and less of that. Right, because the numbers are growing fewer and fewer. You know, whether it's rewind shops, mechanical outfits, integrators, you know, or big distributors like Motion or Applied, right, or Grainger, take your pick, right. So eventually, the acquisition phase will be kaput. There won't be any more, right, and you won't see people getting into the distribution business as a you know, I've rarely see startups. You know, you might see some organization move from one like geography into a new market, but you rarely see brand new distributorships growing. Mm. I think the independent rep agencies are also falling by the wayside. I think that's a slowly changing, evolving group as well. Doesn't matter if it's HTD or PTDA or ESA, you know, the middle people, a lot of them are aging out too. And they're just, there's no incentives to go into that business, even unless it's familial. You know, you have my third generation is going to take over the rep agency. And, you know, then it has its own kind of problems as well, you know, from the inheritance perspective. Now, the distributors, I think, that are embracing the value add will survive and continue to grow and thrive. You know, I've actually addressed that quite a bit because, you know, all the research, you know, think tanks are saying, you know, the distribution's on the decline, you know, and because of the direct business and other things. But I think if you, a distributor focuses on the value add and they're smart about how they run business and have metrics and other factors, they'll survive, you know, and actually grow. But I see an evolution of some business where they're going to get into other things more specific to value add and keep going that direction. And is the purely selling parts, is it really going to still be as profitable as it was in the 80s? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, it's all eroding. So parts business on its own merits. So you know, and that's one of the arguments I always had with like people like Motion Industries that go after contract, or how much money do they make on the actual contracts? Or is this just the fact they beat up all the brands for rebates? You know, there's a whole broader financial discussion about the rebate business and contract business, you know, and that's why a lot of these parts distributors, the logistics companies survive. That's because that's what they do. You know, so I think we're going to see some clear evolution, right, where a lot of brands are taking more of that direct business. And I think a lot of rep agents are going to stop they're just going to focus on OEMs. I think a lot of that's happened in other industries that are parallel to industrial distribution. So I think the surviving rep agents are going to be OEM specific and maybe not even worrying about distribution anymore. You know, it's going to be curious. You know, I don't know. I always talk about having at least 5 years, maybe 10 years left to see how this plays out before I get completely tired of it. But, you know, but I consult a lot. It's amazing the people that call me about some of the things that I talk about, you know, and I've created new tools like the Specialist Health Index. So I measure the health of the specialists within an organization. And it's validated. It's my own design, and it's fascinating too. So you do qualitative reviews, you do a personality review, you know, and then a profile, and then you actually take a survey that I created to discuss actually how healthy your specialists are within the organization. So are they going to stick around? Are they going to? How do they handle leadership? It's fascinating to see the data on that too. It's not published in the book.
and of course, where that, you know, it's fascinating to imagine where the health in the specialist roles and how that will power the value add that you say is so critical to the ongoing success of industrial distribution to get out of just trying to sell parts, obviously, and seeing the future in that value add. So seems to be a massive part of it. And Carl, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It's been a while since I've done a podcast and I know you guys, and I was very excited to participate.
Much appreciated. It was fascinating. Thanks.